Okay, so we were talking about leukemias, which by definition is a quantitative anemia, because you can't make enough of the globin chains. If you can't make beta, it's called beta thalassemia. If you can't make alpha, it's called alpha thalassemia. If you get a double dose of beta, it's called beta thalassemia major or Cooley's anemia. If it's heterozygous, it's called beta thalassemia minor. Okay. So we were talking about the alpha thalassemias, and we talked about there are two genes for the alpha globulins on each chromosome. If you're missing four, it's not compatible with life, and it's called what? Okay, hydrops fetalis is the result. It's called Bart's because they make Bart's hemoglobin, but it's a four-gene deletion you put, four-gene deletion alpha. So alpha, four-gene deletion. Yeah. Alpha, four-gene deletion. Okay, so we're on three-gene deletion. If you have a three-gene deletion, then you have what's known as hemoglobin H disease. Okay? So you could write alpha, three-gene deletion, or hemoglobin H disease. These people have enlarged spleens. They have variable amounts of anemia. And for the women, it seems to be more severe during pregnancy. So they're missing three genes for the alpha chain. So they have too much beta chain. And so those betas will precipitate out as tetramers. And the tetramers will precipitate out in the red cell. So it precipitates out in the membrane of the red cell, and that interferes with the red cell being able to go through the spleen. And so you get usually a hemolytic anemia because the red cells are taken out. So they don't survive as long. So what you see on the laboratory is that you have about 8 to 10 gram hemoglobin. Your retics is slightly elevated. You have a microcytic hypochromic. You have increased RDWs. You have POIC. And since you have increased retics, you'd expect to see polychromatophilia. So these people have then hemoglobin H. So you remember from yesterday that we have to do electrophoresis on hemoglobinopathies. And so the H I told you was the real high speed. Okay. So again, we look at the smear first. We just see a lot of POIC, okay, microcytic hypochromic. We do our electrophoresis. These are the controls. So here's F, here's A. So fast, accelerated. This is A. But you see this other one right off here. So that is H. And we've already talked about how you find H.
Can you explain a little bit what the two speeds mean?
Like when you put a current through a protein, do you know about electrophoresis?
Yeah, but like what effect does it have?
It's a way of diagnosis. Okay?
Can you show one more time like what the controls are and what pressure that means?
Maybe.
You always run controls.
Uh-huh.
This is the patient,
uh-huh,
where this arrow is. So this is an A control. It's only A. Here's F. This is a control that has both, so you can see both positions. And this person out here has H. So it's going beyond. It's faster than either one of those.
So would you say that he has A and H, or just H?
He has some A. So remember how we looked at H's? We did a brilliant crystal blue, and we said that H inclusions show up like golf balls. This is a little bit light, but what we're looking, this is just a peripheral smear. So what we're looking at are these. Remember that H doesn't show in one blob, but it's throughout the cell like a golf ball. So these are just their normal peripheral smear, and you see the hypochromic microcytic, but you see this cell right here looks kind of weird. This one's large, so the retic count's up, so we'd expect that. This one's pretty abnormal. And then what we do is we do a brilliant crystal blue. And so the brilliant crystal blue shows us these H inclusions. And so this makes this a three-gene deletion or hemoglobin H disease. Okay, this is another brilliant crystal blue. It doesn't show quite up, but you can see all of this is full. Okay, can you think of anything else that has inclusions like that? And it only shows up on this stain. You cannot see H inclusions unless you stain it with supravital stain.
Dr. Anderson, so are you going to expect us, some of the hemoglobinopathies where it's kind of difficult to tell which one it is, are you going to give us more information like electrophoresis?
So this is hemoglobin H. So what you see on the peripheral blood is poik, polychromatophilia, hypomicro, you do a brilliant crystal blue and you see H. Okay, on electrophoresis, we're going to have a fast-moving band, real fast. Okay, why do we do iron studies? Rule out iron deficiency. So what do they do for these people? They have to give them blood transfusion if they have any hemolytic crisis that might occur. So infections or oxidative stresses that would cause hemolysis, they have to support them through that time. Okay, so a two-gene deletion. So you could either get an abnormal gene from a parent that has both missing, or you can have one from each parent and still have a two-gene deletion. Okay, so there are different ethnic groups where you get different combinations. Okay, so this is called alpha thalassemia minor. Heterozygous is minor, right? So it's called alpha thalassemia minor. And most of these have no problem at all. Okay, so they have decreased amounts of alpha globin chains, so they can be either a alpha zero and inherit none on one chromosome, or an alpha plus and inherit some on both chromosomes. And this is really common in Southeast Asians, the Chinese, the Filipinos, and about 3% of African Americans have the homozygous form, which is this one right here. Well, this one right here. Okay, so we do see it. Usually they don't have a problem. So the only thing you're going to see in the lab might be slightly hypochromic. They might be microcytic. They may have poik and target cells, but target cells just means hemoglobinopathy, and you have to figure out what it is. Their RDW is usually normal, might be slightly increased. If you think they have this, you have to do a BCB prep, and you have to look for H inclusions, and you may have to scan 100 fields in order to find one. Okay, so it's not real noticeable like the hemoglobin H disease. If you were suspecting this and you wanted to do it on cord blood, you could do it and you'd find about 5 to 15% BARDS. But after 3 months, they're normal. So you'd have to do it on cord blood or infant blood. So this would be a typical smear. So some of these look kind of microcytic, don't they? Okay, if we see basophilic stippling, it's not real diagnostic, but it indicates hemoglobinopathy, some problem making the cells. Okay, but we did a BCB prep and found this one, one. So this is hemoglobin H inclusions. These are not hemoglobin H. So they're not real prominent. You'd have to hunt and hunt and hunt.
Would cause you to do this if they don't have any signs of disease?
Well, if they were slightly microcytic, you might, and their irons are normal. Okay, if you have only a one gene deletion, you're called a silent carrier. Okay, if you're a silent carrier, the reason you'd want to know that is because you could pass along your abnormal gene, right? So you could create a problem in the next generation. So the indices on these people are normal, but maybe they have a kid that has a problem that's microcytic, and so they'll go back and do the parents. Not usually hematology, but okay. So you'll just find a real rare hemoglobin H inclusion. So you may have to do 500 fields to find one. But that's what you'd look for. So again, you can be a heterozygote where you would have this type of genetic setup, and about 20%, 28% of African Americans have this with an H or an alpha plus. And so we do see it, but they don't have any problem. But it may be in the next generation where you're looking for these. So they go back and do the genetic studies. So this is one gene deletion or a silent carrier. So you're not really going to see anything. If you suspect it, you can do cord blood again, and you'd find about 1 to 2% BARTs. But otherwise, you'd just see a rare hemoglobin inclusion, H inclusion. So if we put them all together, so if we have normocytic, normochromic, and we suspect something, we could do a BCB. Okay, it's going to be a rare hemoglobin H inclusion. That's a silent carrier. We see target cells in POIC. We do BCB. We see occasional, then it's trait. And the only way to distinguish them, really, these people don't have any problems. These people may, so you might be slightly decreased. You do hemoglobin electrophoresis on cord blood. The most BART's going to be found in a trait. So it just gets less and less. So these people don't have to be treated. Okay, let's talk about hemoglobin constant spring, because it's kind of considered an alpha thalassemia-like disease. So homozygotes and heterozygotes. Again, homozygotes might have some problem. They get mild anemia, mild jaundice. This constant spring is very common in Thailand, in Chinese and Greek ancestry, just like the alpha thalassemias. And it may occur in about 40% of hemoglobin H disease in the Southeast Asians. So constant spring is a different kind of hemoglobin. So it's named, the hemoglobins as they were discovered, they started with A for adult and F, and C and S. We've already talked about those, but they ran out of alphabet. And so they started naming them where they found them. And so it's called the constant spring. And it's formed because you get two abnormal alpha chains, and these are elongated chains. And they kind of have abnormal function. And so they produce, because they're longer than normal, they produce this thalassemia-like syndrome. So it is an abnormal alpha chain. It's elongated by 31 amino acids.
So in this, you can have hemoglobin H and hemoglobin C. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so what do you see in the patient? Just a mild microhypo, retic slightly increased, anisopoic, see target cells. Osmotic fragility slightly increased. This is a slide from a constant spring. It doesn't really grab you about anything. So just real slight abnormalities. And you have to do electrophoresis again. And since it's a different hemoglobin, it migrates in a different place. So when you start a hemoglobin, the place you start with the electricity, the place you apply it is called the origin. And right there is where you have the enzyme that's called carbonic anhydrase. And you'll see that protein right at the origin. Well, constant spring migrates between the CA and the A2. So it's really, really slow. It hardly gets off the starting block. And so that's where it migrates. And so in a homozygote, you're going to see about 5 to 7%. And the A2 and the F are normal. If you were to test, you might find some BARTs at birth. But the heterozygotes just have a very slight amount of constant spring. So what you're looking for in this one is if they have microhypo and they're not H, okay, then do the electrophoresis. And if you see a real slow migrating band that's right at the origin, that's constant spring. Okay, usually they don't have any problem and you don't need to treat them. So we've talked about all the alpha thalassemias. And they put this in here just because it produces a syndrome like alpha thalassemia. So it fits into the syndrome. So we said hydrops fetalis, hemoglobin H, minor and trait is the same thing, and then silent carrier. Okay, so we have four genes for alphas. All right. So what do we do to test for these thalassemias? What's the most important thing? Well, they're going to be microcytic, so we got to use something else besides microcytic. So we use the MCH, we use iron studies just to eliminate iron deficiency so that we know it's not iron deficiency. Because thalassemia is inherited, right? So there's nothing you could do to fix it necessarily. Then we do hemoglobin electrophoresis. So hemoglobin electrophoresis is pretty qualitative. You can see the different spots, but it's really hard to be very precise as to how much. Okay, the next thing we do is we quantify the A2. Because you remember in beta thal, A2 gets increased. And normally it's not very high, so to see an increase you'd have to have really good eyes on your electrophoresis. You can tell. But it'd be better if we could quantify it. So we do hemoglobin A2s. Okay, then we do BCB preps. And we do BCB preps to look for hemoglobin H. So that'd be the alpha thals. And then we also quantify the F, because again, you can see a little mark on the F, but we'd want to know how much F is there. Okay, and then we look at the morphology of the cells. Okay. So now, macrocytic anemias, and we're going to cover this on the exam. So get ready. We have to get through this to differentiate it from micro-hypo. There is a chart in your book on page 168 that you need to look at. It's this chart right here, because we've talked about reticulocyte production indexes. And those are good ways to put it either into micro-hypo or macrocytic. So if you look up here, this is the macrocytic greater than 2. If you have a survival defect, if it's less than 2, then we're going to talk about the things that usually happens. It's megaloblastic. Okay, if it's microcytic, the thing that will help us here is our retics are usually normal, but we do serum ferritin levels. And if they're normal to increase, then we have some sort of blockage. And if they're decreased, it's almost always iron deficiency, right? Reticulocyte production index. Okay, so let's talk about the macrocytic anemias. So if we were to say greater than what size would be considered macrocytic? Okay, 8.5, 8 point something, but around there. Okay, what about the MCV? Okay, we usually say 100. Okay, so if they're over that, then think macrocytic. Then you have to decide, are they megaloblastic or are they normoblastic? So remember what megaloblastic means? It means that the DNA replication and the cell division don't synchronize. So the nucleus kind of lags behind. So it looks really more delicate or more immature than the cytoplasm indicates. So we have to distinguish between megaloblastic and non-megaloblastic. So megaloblastic anemias are caused either by B12 deficiency or folic acid deficiency. So B12 deficiency, you eat in your diet. So here is B12 right here. It goes into the stomach, and in the stomach there is a factor called intrinsic factor that binds up with vitamin B12. And as it binds it, it protects it as it goes through the stomach so that it won't get digested. So it carries it out of the stomach and it goes through the duodenum and goes down into the distal ileum. And right here in the distal ileum is where B12 really is absorbed into the system. So for iron, if you compare it with iron, we said that iron comes in as ferric down in the stomach. Some of it's converted by HCl to ferrous, goes down into the duodenum, and that's where iron is absorbed, is in the duodenum area and in the proximal jejunum. But B12 has to go clear down to the distal ileum to get absorbed. So we have to have intrinsic factor in the stomach that's produced by the cells, parietal cells, in order to absorb B12. So that the absorption actually takes place in the ileum. And then you store B12 in your liver. And you have enough B12 usually through your diet. If you eat green leafy things and meats and eggs and milk and all that kind of stuff, all of them have B12. And you can store up to B12. Usually you have years of storage. You don't have to worry about being depleted very fast. So again, here's B12. And so B12 is also called cobalamin. And the reason it's called cobalamin is that it's B12 is centered in the inside of cobalamin. The cobalamin is the shell, just like heme is the shell for iron. Well, cobalamin is the shell for B12. And so it comes in the diet. You bind it with intrinsic factor. You make this complex. Goes through to the distal ileum, and then it's absorbed through the epithelial cells of the distal ileum, gets into the bloodstream, and there has to be a carrier protein, right? So the carrier protein for iron was what? Transferrin. But now the carrier protein for B12 is called transcobalamin. And so there's a transcobalamin 1, transcobalamin 2, and a transcobalamin 3. The one that usually picks up the B12 at the ileum is usually transcobalamin 2. Okay? Once it's into the system, one can carry it as well. Okay, transcobalamin 3 actually comes from the granulocytes, so we don't usually worry about that one. So here's another picture of, here's the jejunum, the duodenum's up here. Here's the intrinsic factor binding to B12. Has to come clear down to the ileum, comes across into the portal bloodstream through the liver, and that's where you store it. So right here, the thing that's carrying B12 is usually transcobalamin 2. But once it's got into the systemic blood, most of it's carried by transcobalamin 1. Once it gets back into the bloodstream. Okay, so if you have a problem with B12, you're going to have abnormal DNA synthesis. In the United States, it's not very common that you wouldn't take in enough dietary vitamin B12. That's not a very common cause. Most of the time, what people have as a problem is an antibody to the intrinsic factor. And if you have an antibody to the intrinsic factor, it blocks the intrinsic factor, so it can't bind B12. Therefore, you can't carry the B12 to the distal ileum to be absorbed. So it's usually an autoimmune, if you want to call it that, disorder where you make antibodies against your own intrinsic factor. I mean, you could have a problem with your intestinal tract where your ileum is not functional. So you could have a decreased absorption, or you might have some anatomical problem where you don't have an ileum or very much of one. Rarely you could have a transcobalamin 2 deficiency. You can't make that, so you can't carry it. There can be other kinds of things, but the main one is antibodies to the intrinsic factor. So this vitamin B12 deficiency usually occurs in people that are over 40. It comes on very slow, So the people get very low in hemoglobin before they even notice that they're real tired. Then they start feeling fatigue and weakness. And they have sort of a yellowish, waxy paleness when they get anemic. They have a smooth tongue. They have gastrointestinal complaints. And they have, if it goes on for a long period of time, neurological problems. So they have tingling in their fingers, their toes. They have mental changes. So many of these people were institutionalized because they didn't know they had this, and they called it megaloblastic madness. They can't walk very well, so they have sort of a spastic gait. So this is kind of the yellow, waxy, pale that you see in a person that has vitamin B12 deficiency. So they have kind of a lemon, yellow appearance. You'll notice her hemoglobin was 7 and her MCV was 132. So she has this pallor because of the anemia, but she also has cells that are not coming out of the bone marrow. They're actually lysed in the bone marrow, so she has a slight increase in bilirubin. So with the pale and the bilirubin, it makes kind of a lemon yellow color. They have sort of a smooth tongue that's called glossitis. Can be very painful. Okay. This is glossitis, and another name we use for B12 deficiency is called pernicious anemia. And pernicious was used because it was untreatable. Now we don't use that because we can treat it. But we still call it PA, okay, pernicious anemia. It's kind of the beefy red tongue. This is a little kid who had actually one of the rare things where they didn't have transcobalamin 2. And so this little child then had the macrocytic anemia and had megaloblastic changes just because he didn't have the carrier protein to help absorb the B12. So what you have to remember in this particular anemia is that it's going to affect all cell lines because it affects DNA. So that's why you get the neurologic problems. So you're going to have a decrease in neutrophils. You're going to have hypersegmented neutrophils and eosinophils. You're going to have a decrease in platelets. And sometimes these platelets are pretty big when they are produced. You're going to have a macrocytic normochromic anemia. The thing that's the hallmark is to look for oval macrocytes. You're going to have aneso and poik. You're going to see some probably nucleated reds. You're going to see Hal Jolly bodies, basophilic stippling, Cabot rings. And your reticulocyte relative number is normal, but your RPI is going to be less than 2. So that will help you. So what we see on the smear, look for the oval macrocytes. That's pretty common in these people. So here again is our marker. Here's our lymphocyte. So these cells are pretty large. But you're going to have an MCV if you calculate your indices, right? Okay, also look to see if you have hypersegmentation. So if you look at your neutrophils, you ought to be able to pick that up. If you see macrocytes, or you suspect macrocytes, then look for hypersegmentation. So I don't know how many segments are there, but let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And if you have over how many?
5.
You got hypersegmentation. Okay. Here's a nice Cabot ring. Okay, that's really hard to find, but we do have pictures of those, so it's not uncommon to be on a test because we do have pictures. Okay, so if you looked at the bone marrow, what you'd see is hypercellularity. The MU ratio is about 1 to 1. What's a normal MU ratio? About 3 to 4 to 1, somewhere around there. Okay, they're megaloblastic. So you're going to look in the erythroid series. It's in all series, but look in the erythroid because you can tell them. And then look for giants, you know. You already know what a giant metamyelocyte is or a giant band, right? Look for giants in this. So if you remember your maturation cycle, these are starting out big. These are already megaloblastic. So here's a pro-megaloblast, basophilic megaloblast, polychromatophilic megaloblast, orthochromic normal megaloblast. This is a huge polychromatophilic cell. And here's the oval macrocyte. So in a real bone marrow, you're looking for what we call megaloblastic changes, which means that the nucleus lagged behind the cytoplasm. So some of these are pretty weird. You have abnormal nuclear division. So what's this going to be right here in a normal cell? Hal Jolly body. Okay. So can you tell how delicate this nuclear material is? Okay, so what can you say about this if you saw bone marrow? Megaloblastic changes. So there are also some chemistries that will help you here. You get an increased lactic dehydrogenase activity. You get increase in bilirubin, which would then decrease your haptoglobin. You're going to see increases in iron, but you're not going to think this is iron deficiency, are you? If we have a macrocytic cell? Okay, don't think that. So the diagnosis has to become by doing B12 levels, and the B12 has to be decreased. The other test that we do to see if a person has B12 deficiency is called a Schilling's test. And a Schilling's test is less than 7%. Okay, the way you do a Schilling's test is you give the patient radioactive B12. And then you collect urine and you see how much radioactivity is in the urine. Okay, if they're able to absorb it normally, okay, that's great. But what if they don't? It won't come out in the urine, right? Because in order to get in the urine, you got to go through the bloodstream. So if they can't absorb it, it's going to be less than 7%. So then what you do is you do it again on them, and this time you give them radioactive B12, but you also give them intrinsic factor. And now if it normalizes and is greater than 7%, it tells you they have B12 deficiency that's due to antibody against intrinsic factor.
Because there's a DNA problem, you also see other systemic problems like muscle wasting and things like that.
Not usually muscle, it usually manifests in the neurologic. So they have tingling, paresthesia, can't walk. Okay? Haptoglobin is the binding protein for hemoglobin. And we're not going to focus on that too much because that's chemistry, but just so you know, there are chemistry abnormalities as well. Okay, so up here in your peripheral smear, what you see are oval macrocytes, segmented neutrophils or eosinophils. Your RPI is less than 2. So you do B12 level. You can do the Schilling's test as well. Okay, leads us to think that they have B12 deficiency.
The question. Uh-huh. How do you know that what's the normal range for B12? Or will it just say it's decreased?
It'll say decreased because it depends on which method you use.
Okay, so I have to know a range.
Or else we give it to you.
Okay.
Okay, so what do they do for these people? Because it's not pernicious anymore. Now that they've identified what the problem is, they give them B12 shots. You can't give it by mouth because they don't have the intrinsic factor, right? Usually. They have an antibody against it. So you give them shots of B12, and then they're fine.
Does that need to be already coupled with thrombus?
No, because it goes directly into the bloodstream. You don't have to absorb it. Okay, so if in the olden days when you couldn't treat it, pernicious anemia, many of these people were institutionalized because they had megaloblastic anemia. Okay, there is a fish tapeworm that also sucks out vitamin B12. Okay, Diphyllobothrium latum is the way I say it, but whatever. So that's another possibility. If you're infested with that fish tapeworm, you could get B12 deficiency. Okay, folic acid. If you don't have enough folic acid, which is also called pterol, monoglutamic acid, you could have megaloblastic anemia. So what folic acid is by taking pteroic acid and putting one glutamic acid with it, and you produce folic acid, also called folate. And it is a little bit different than B12. It's absorbed mainly in the jejunum. And then you have to metabolize it by using a reductase and adding two hydrogens to make it active. And the active form is called tetrahydrofolate, or FH4. Thing also different about this one is that you get it with green leafy things that most of us don't like. I'd rather have chocolate than green leafy things. But usually on the diet, you have to have enough that you have some all the time, because you can only store a month's worth or so in your liver. So you can deplete folic acid pretty fast, whereas B12 you could go for years. So how you absorb it then is over here. So you, right here, take in your diet folic acid, and then you absorb it mainly in the jejunum, and then with these D conjugases it makes it active, and you pull it into the bloodstream, and it has a protein that binds with it. Has this huge long name of binding protein, so it's just a protein that binds it. Now, what you need to see here is that here's a small intestine, and so we have this dietary folate that we take in, we methylate it, or put some hydrogens on it, bring it into the cell membrane, and then it is involved in DNA synthesis. So what you notice is that here's B12. So B12 and folic acid are both involved in DNA synthesis. So they have kind of a relationship together. So again, this just shows you, here's B12, and it's involved in this methyl 4, H4, and it has to be involved then to get DNA. So what you're going to see in a folic acid deficiency is the very same thing that you see in a B12. So you have to distinguish them, and you can't looking at a blood smear. You can if you look at the patient's symptoms, and you can if you do a folic acid and a B12 analysis. But that's the only way. So if you were to give a person who has folic acid deficiency really massive doses of B12, it would cause a response because those pathways are the same. So, you know, they used to just treat everybody by giving them shots of B12. Well, it doesn't really help the folic acid that long. It helps them in a short period, but it's a different thing. So usually the way you get folic acid deficient is to not eat those green leafy things. So if you don't do that within a month or two, you become folic acid deficient.
Is that at all related to that, or is folic acid?
Yeah, because of the DNA synthesis, but the demand from the pregnancy causes deficiency in folic acid rather quick because you don't have a store of it. Okay?
Are there any like digestive abnormalities that would cause folic acid?
Yeah, these right here.
Oh.
So if you have non-tropical sprue, which is the wheat or the gluten sensitivity, or the tropical sprue, that's malabsorption, so you don't absorb it. And also there are certain drugs that interfere with the enzymes. And so if you're on Dilantin, Phenytoin, or Methotrexate for anti-chemo or chemotherapy, those will also cause folic acid deficiencies. So it affects the blood system and the gastrointestinal system. The thing that's different between it and B12 is that there is no neurologic damage. So you don't get the tingling, you don't get the memory problem, you don't get the problem walking. So if there's no neurologic abnormality, it's usually folic acid. Okay, these people mostly are food faddists. They go on maybe a high carbohydrate with no green leafy things at all. Or the place we see it most often is people that like alcohol better than they like food. So they deplete their folic acid pretty fast. Here's a little kid with celiac disease. It's a two-year-old boy who developed megaloblastic anemia because of folic acid deficiency. And so since it's absorbed in the jejunum, if you have a problem with that absorption, it'll cause folic acid deficiency. This is a person who has a bruise because of a megaloblastic anemia with a folic acid deficiency because she was alcoholic. So remember, this affects the whole hematopoietic system. So platelets are decreased, white cells are decreased, red cells are decreased. So if you look, she had an 8.1 gram hemoglobin, MCV was 115, platelet count was 200,000. So bruising is because of platelet abnormalities.
Okay, that was the
question. So what do you see in the lab? See the same thing that you're going to see with B12 deficiency. You're going to see macrocytic, normochromic. You're going to see macro-ovalocytes. You're going to see nucleated reds, Cabot rings, Hal Jolly bodies, basophilic stippling, retics, normal to increased, no polychromasia because your RPI is less than 2. Okay? So your RDW is normal to increased. So again, what you see on the smear, you look for macrocytes. So these are macrocytic. Here's a nice oval one. This one's almost oval. So they're quite oval, big. And in the bone marrow, you're going to see the same thing. You're going to see megaloblastic changes. So giant bands, giant metas. Megakaryocytes can be weird. We haven't talked about what they really look like. So what you're going to look for would be megaloblastic changes. So this is pretty typical of a severe megaloblastic anemia. So look at the neutrophil count, the white cell count, 1.9, platelets 53,000, MCV 129, hematocrits 18, red cells 1.4, hemoglobin 5.1. So these people are very severe. They don't know they're so tired because it happens over a long period of time. You know, months, not just days. But folic acid's a little bit faster. So here's your bone marrow.
How, if you get injections, how fast can you restore?
Well, it takes a while, but you start to retic within 3 to 5 days. But to get it all back, if you're a 18% hemoglobin, it takes a while. So here's megaloblastic change in the bone marrow. So if I show you this bone marrow, can you see this weird-looking polychromatophilic megaloblast? Okay, look at this, and it has two lobes. Can you see how they're lagging? Here's a giant what? Meta, maybe. This is should be a little more pycnotic here to be extruded from that. Okay, so all you say is megaloblastic changes, okay? So the same thing in the chemistry lab. The only thing different is now you do a folate level, and you can do it on serum or red blood cells, and it's decreased. Whereas B12 is usually normal. It can be slightly decreased, but usually normal. Okay, this is a breakdown product of B12, so it's going to be normal. So here's our diagnostic scheme. So platelets decreased, hemoglobin, hematocrit decreased, red cell or white cells decreased, RPI less than 2. Do your B12, usually normal, folic acids decrease. So you're going to look for macro-ovalocytes and segmented neutrophils, hypersegmented. So what do you have to do for these people? You have to give them folic acid. Then you say, quit drinking alcohol and eat green leafy things. Okay, there are other types of megaloblastics. If you have a cancer and you give them methotrexate, then it's going to cause a folic acid deficiency, which would be megaloblastic. This is also a malignancy. There is one hereditary one that's called hereditary orotic aciduria, where it blocks the pyrimidine synthesis, and that causes a DNA problem, but they're pretty rare. Okay, so those are megaloblastic. So if you have macrocytes and they're not megaloblastic, they're called non-megaloblastic macrocytic anemia. And probably the biggest thing there is liver disease. Now, if the liver disease causes folic acid, that doesn't count because that's megaloblastic, right? But alcohol itself is toxic. And it can do lots of different things. So I'll show you what the effects of alcohol are on the bone marrow. But you can also have alteration of plasma lipids. If you remember back to sideroblastic anemia, one of the secondary causes was ethanol. So that can cause it. You can have liver disease that causes iron deficiency, but it wouldn't be macrocytic. And then you can have liver disease that causes a problem with lipids and membranes in it. And again, it causes anemia, but it's hemolytic. It's usually normocytic, normochromic. So liver disease, especially due to alcoholism, can cause anything. And normocytic. So the thing is, don't drink alcohol. Okay, so one of the causes of macrocytosis, alcoholism, liver disease. So we're not going to talk about all these because we already did some, but what you see in liver disease can be that you have decreased platelets because it's toxic to the bone marrow. You also have decreased leukocytes because it's toxic to the bone marrow. And they look weird. They have all these vacuoles in them. So it really is toxic. And so this is a bone marrow from a person that has liver disease due to alcoholism. So if you look, that alcohol effect on the bone marrow is not good. So these are the kinds of vacuoles that you'll see due to alcoholism. So that's the story for alcohol. Don't drink. Okay, this is from your book. I think it's right across from the page where 168, but I'm not positive. What it's showing is that we have talked about the maturation defects so far. So we've talked about problems in the bone marrow where they can't get out. There's ineffective erythropoiesis. And if it's cytoplasmic, we only see it affecting the erythrocytes. So with iron deficiency, the thalassemias, it's cytoplasmic problem because it's a problem dividing because of the globin. Okay? If it's a nuclear problem, then it affects all cell lines. So platelets, white cells, and red cells. So we talk about megaloblastic. So these are maturation problems. These have problems inserting something or making the globin chains. But this one involves the DNA. Okay, so megaloblastics, and we've talked about these three. We're going to talk about these next week, but this is just kind of a neat little chart. We haven't talked about proliferation defects yet, but it's kind of a neat little chart. So I need to tell you that tomorrow, everything that I've said is on the test. And there is the lab test contains the slides, and it has a separate sheet of paper where you only answer on this piece of paper. And then I'll put your total score in for you. So don't waste time writing on the test, okay? Just put it on the paper. And it has probably, I don't know, I forgot to count, 20 case histories that you're going to have to analyze and tell me what you see and then what it means. You're also going to review all the inclusions in red cells, okay, and abnormal shapes of red cells. So there are some identification slides as well. So the lab test is going to take you 2.5 to 3 hours, I would guess. So what we want you to do is to use from 7:30 a.m. until ending at 12 p.m. to do the practical. The practical is a retic count and 2 slides. You don't have to count anything on the slides. You have to scan it, tell me what you see, and make a diagnosis. And so it's the ones you've been doing, and you're going to review them again today. The lecture test is strictly questions with multiple choice, but it's a lot of calculation again. So what's the first thing you're going to do if you get patients? Okay, then you can guess. If it's microcytic, guess something microcytic. Okay? All right, good luck.